You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts in a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps
and
Tasha Robinson.
Genevieve Kosky is behind the boards this week, cowering in fear, but she'll be with us again on a less spooky episode. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, parental grief and psychic distress are the twin engines that power two terrifying films about the lingering impact of a death in the family. Tasha, it's the middle of summer and you're wearing a heavy red coat. What's that all about?
Oh, I mean, I'm a ghastly premonition of your doom. Also, I thought I might get drafty in the studio.
Okay. I'm scared but intrigued. What's this week's pairing?
Since Hereditary premiered in the midnight section at the Sundance Film Festival, it's been the most talked about horror film of 2018. Written and directed by first-timer Ari Aster, the film starts with the death of a mysterious, diabolical old woman and considers how her passing affects her daughter, played by Toni Collette. She and her family are each left to deal in their own way with a deadly supernatural inheritance. Aster turned to a number of classic sources for Hereditary, including Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist, but the standout influence is Nicholas Roeg's form-busting 1973 thriller Don't Look Now. Based on a story by Daphne du Maurier, who also wrote the stories that formed the basis for Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds and Rebecca, Don't Look Now also starts with a death in the family, and it similarly follows parents whose lingering grief manifests into a terrifying new threat to their marriage and their lives.
Both movies are also, it should be said, freaky as hell. And the reason they're freaky as hell isn't entirely owed to Aster and Roeg's considerable capacities to shock. The intensity of emotion in Hereditary and Don't Look Now are integral to the horror. As the parents in both films seek answers for this hole in their lives, their desperation raises the stakes and feeds into the atmosphere. On today's show, we'll look into Don't Look Now and its innovative approach to sex and death in the shadows of Venice. Then next week, we'll bring in Hereditary and unpack all 127 minutes of the densest and most ambitious horror film in recent memory. Tasha, please take off that red coat and stay a while, unless you're hiding a knife under there.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
They say seeing is believing, but only a split second of time separates the past from the future. The present is crushed between them. A thin thread of life in a skein of death.
Looking at?
I don't know what's happening.
You are warned. Things are not what they seem. Don't look now.
I can remember exactly where I was when I first saw Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now. I was an undergrad at the University of Georgia in the early 90s, taking the second part of a two-part course on the history of cinema. The class was early in the morning, and since I was a night owl, I always arrived a little tired and had a tendency to drift off whenever the professor turned out the lights and screened something for us. We were working on a section about montage editing techniques, so naturally he screened Don't Look Now, so we could all appreciate the associative power of its images. I recall watching the bulk of the film in a state of half-sleep, which isn't that bad a way to experience it, honestly. But then suddenly, when it got to the end and Donald Sutherland is confronted by the dwarf in the red coat, the shock was so great it felt like an ice pick stabbing my brain. It was like emerging from a nightmare, only to discover that it was real. I've seen Don't Look Now a few times since then, fully awake, and yet the experience is remarkably similar. It's a film that holds viewers in a trance, where you lose yourself in images that associate with each other without binding together in the order you expect from a conventional narrative. In the Criterion edition of Don't Look Now, director Danny Boyle talks about how, in the films of Nicholas Roeg, quote, time is always present, which is an elegant way to describe how tragedy and grief attach themselves to the parents in the film. After we see them lose their daughter to a drowning accident in the brilliant opening sequence, John and Laura, played by Sutherland and Julie Christie, spend the rest of the film in Venice, where they're trying to get away from the British home where the accident happened. And what they discover, of course, is that they can't get away from it. Time has collapsed in a way, because such a tragedy is not only inescapable, but winds up manifesting itself in new horrors. The one possibility of relief that presents itself are the visions of a blind seer that Laura meets in a restaurant. Two old women, one of them psychic, tell Laura that her daughter is happy and present, and for a moment she feels this immense burden being lifted. Later that evening, she and John express the relief in one of cinema's most artful sex sequences, which, in typical time-jumbling Roeg fashion, cuts between graphic lovemaking and shots of them getting dressed afterwards. Steven Soderbergh, a big admirer of Roeg's editing style, would famously modify that sequence to his own end and out of sight. And yet, Laura and John's relief is short-lived. As John attempts to throw himself into his work restoring an old church, the past, present, and future start to merge in mysterious and threatening ways. We don't know how much time has passed between his daughter's death and his time in Venice, but it might as well be yesterday. Certain visual motifs, like water, broken glass, and the red raincoat his daughter is wearing, keep recurring, and the presence of another diminutive figure in a red coat heightens the confusion. At the beginning of the film, John feels something is wrong, and his extrasensory perception leads him to rush outside to find his daughter in the lake. Now, in Venice, he's feeling something again, but he can't be sure if it's the past catching up to him, or portents of a future he can't quite see. And that's the special magic of Don't Look Now. Roeg's style is unsettling because we don't have any firm footing in time, yet there's a cohesiveness to the images that keep resurfacing and the lingering emotions that John and Laura are feeling. Roeg pulls off one of the all-time great shocks at the end, but it only works because it suspends us in a hypnotic state for so long. We'll talk about the hows and the whys of it after the break.
Goodness, you do remind me of my daughter.
Oh, really?
Only her hair's dark.
Oh. Well, here, take your handkerchief.
You're sad. You're so sad, and there's no need to be.
My sister's psychic.
She wants you to know. I've seen her, and she wants you to know that she's happy. I've seen your little girl sitting between you and your husband, and she was laughing. Yes. Oh, yes, she's with you. She's with you, my dear. And she's laughing.
Sorry, it was dead.
She's wearing a shiny little mac. Christy. Oh, but she's laughing. She's happy as can be.
So I've told you about my history with Don't Look Now. What is your history, and how does it hold up for you in the year 2018?
I love it. Roeg is a favorite, and this is a period when he could do no wrong, essentially. I think it's the only second time I've seen it, and I think the first time I saw it was on VHS, so I was happy to watch this on a nice Blu-ray many years later. And I would say, if anything, it's, not to get too autobiographical here, but it's more chilling now as a parent to watch this movie than as a callow youth when all this sort of loss was more theoretical.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. And she looks a lot like your daughter.
I know. She does. She looks a lot like my daughter.
Whoa.
Yep. I don't think she owns a red raincoat. I'm never going to get her a red raincoat.
I mean, every time you saw her from behind, you'd get wigged out. And every time you saw her from the front, you'd get sad.
Yeah.
Stabbed or sad?
Sad.
Probably both.
A little from column A. Yeah. A little from column B. Yeah. So I was watching this movie last night with my husband, and he said, oh, this is one of the first movies I ever showed you. There was a period, like we met our first year in college, and there was a period where he was kind of running me through like some of the films that were most meaningful to him, like Wings of Desire and Double Life of Veronique and Julia and this one. And, you know, there isn't a dud in the bunch. So I kind of came to it through the advocacy of somebody who loved it. And I suspect that kind of carried me through during an era where, you know, I I grew up watching like films in the 1980s, and like if you grew up on a steady diet of like Ghostbusters, this movie is challenging. Mm-hmm. It's recondite and it's complicated and it's sleepy at times and it's disassociative. And then there are just these incredibly emotional, jarring moments where you can't quite believe what you're seeing on screen. Mm-hmm. The whole business in the church with the scaffolding is up there, and like the nightmarish sequence that he goes through when he thinks he sees his wife on a boat passing on the Grand Canal. I mean, none of these things are as shocking as that ending, but they all kind of come through with that clarity of nightmare. So, like, I don't think it's a perfect film. I still to this day like wish it was a little tighter, that I had a little more sense of Sutherland, like what matters to Sutherland. I see all these things in him about what he does and doesn't want to deal with, what he does and doesn't care about, but I still end up finding him kind of a mystery as a character. But that said, I mean, it's one of the all-time great shock endings, and yeah. you really can't beat it. But,
I mean, does it freak you out to see it? I mean, does it still, it's not just me then who's like, I mean, I guess it is a fairly famous shock ending, but every single time I see this film, it just knocks me out. I know it's coming and it still gets me.
I mean, it doesn't in the same sort of way, because not in the way of I know what's coming so it's not scary anymore, so much as I find myself super braced up for, oh, this is so eerie. Yeah. And so it can't quite be as eerie as the imagination's built it into. But her face, her completely blank face, like if she snarled at him or screamed at him or something, it would be so much less uncanny and unnerving. But like her calm in that moment is endlessly unsettling.
I think also for a film that is at least partially about fate being a circle from which you can't escape, I find myself at the beginning and end of this movie just thinking, oh, don't do that. Just don't, you can stop this. You know, your girl's going to drown. You're going to get stabbed by this dwarf. Just stop. And then like the rhythms of the film are such that you're just kind of drawn to it like a, you know, gravitational pull that you can't escape. You know, it's part of what makes the film so effective.
Yeah. It's really common in films to have somebody with some form of psychic power. It is not so common to have somebody with a psychic power that only alerts you when it's too late to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And that moment where he suddenly snaps to in the beginning, but you know from having watched the film before, even from just the way it plays out, you know by the time he snaps to, it's already too late. And it's just so much of a tragedy. That scene does play very different for me now, just because, like, I mean, I grew up as a free-range kid. Like, we lived, like, four blocks from a library. And, like, at 7 years old, I was walking to the library by myself, hanging out there, getting books, and coming back. And nobody thought anything of it. Mm-hmm. Watching this today, I've got a little feeling of, why are you letting your child play by the lake alone? What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that feeds into the movie, too. That comes up in conversation. I think Donald Sutherland's character, who has allowed the children to play back there, and she lays a pretty strong guilt trip on him for that. But as far as the effectiveness of the film, I think so much of it relies, well, there's two things. I mean, one is this mix of the supernatural, which makes many things possible, and a very strong emotional realism, I suppose, a very relatable emotional situation. So there's that. And then the other thing is just Rogue's really adventurous narrative strategy of combining these colors and these images and these motifs that keep coming back. All of that kind of feeds into the intensity of the movie. And I think that's kind of what gives that the payoff of the film so much of its shock value, is just like, oh, is this rush of images that have been accumulating this whole film? They lead to this sort of natural and horrific end. And it's a payoff to a style that I think it was a huge gamble. I mean, it's something that Nicholas Rogue himself had been working on for a while from his first film as a director, which is Performance, which he made with Mick Jagger, was the other credited director.
No, Donald Campbell is the other
Donald Campbell, okay. Director. But that one is pretty radically edited. But I think this has got a little bit more of a, it's a little more purposeful, I would say, the editing in this than Performance.
Well, and like Point Blank, you know, John Borman's Point Blank, it owes a lot to Petulia, which is really Richard Lester's, one of my favorite movies of all time, Richard Lester's film starring Julie Christie and George C. Scott. And the editing style is very much there. And Rogue was a cinematographer on that film. So he was able to kind of witness firsthand how this is being put together and ran with it for the rest of his career, really, especially in these early days.
Definitely.
And to me, it's, I know you studied it. I'm sure you can do a shot-by-shot analysis of it, but it almost just feels just kind of instinctual to me. There's a kind of magic to what he does with editing here, the match cuts and the sort of the transitions from one to the other in this imperfect rhythm. He does it as these wonderful grace notes throughout the film, but the beginning and the end and the famous love scene, just the mind boggles as to how well those are put together.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that the love scene, the way that ended up being cut together, was one of those things born out of necessity, that the sex scene was so graphic and so challenging to the ratings board that he had to go back and figure out ways to make it as intense as he wanted it to be, while also abiding by, you know, the spirit of the censors and what they wanted him, you know, what they needed from the scene as well. And things like the censors didn't want, like, thrusting, for example, and so on the thrust he would cut to them getting dressed, and he just ended up with this totally bewitching sequence that is completely within the style of the film anyway, editing-wise, which is why I was surprised just to read about this anecdote at all, because I just figured, hey, that's his whole way of making this movie. Of course he did it that way. That's the way he made this film. But in fact, that specific sequence was born out of troubles with censors.
I mean, that actually makes me wonder if he went back and made other scenes match with sort of the feel of that, you know, the beginning where you're getting those cuts. It's very abrupt. Like, the match cuts are, to me, actually very jarring, because they're so, some of the inserts are so brief, and they happen so quickly. And it would make sense to me if he was actually doing that stylistically to match with what he had to do with the love scene.
Well, maybe, but I mean, the other elements of the film are pretty obviously carefully planned in the shooting, though. I mean, like, the beginning of the film, I mean, that is the configuration of the blood and the water and all of this very specific curvature in the film. I mean, that is something you can't edit to create. That is something you have to have thought through before you even, you know, start making the movie. And so that part of it was thought through, and maybe, I guess, he just improvised something here. Though I wonder about, like, was there, like, a scene of them getting just dressed afterwards where they, maybe it was a dialogue scene and that he cut up or something like that. Maybe that's the way it worked. But the way it plays out in the film, the getting dressed part is like crazy sexy, right? In a way that makes it seem totally planned. No?
I mean, just, it's a wonderful depiction of afterglow. I mean, just sort of like looking, being very comfortable with each other, admiring each other, you know, reflecting on what just happened. I mean, this is something you don't really see in films very often, with hot married sex. It's sex between people who know each other. It's not, there's no surprises, but there's all satisfaction when two people who have spent their lives together and are comfortable around each other. And it's just usually, you know, in movies you see first couplings or the heat of passion of a young love. And this is something different. And I think it's part of what sets it apart.
I think in context, though, you would have to say that it's likely that they've never been able to have sex as freely, or maybe even at all. We don't know how much time has passed, of course, between when the daughter dies and when they're in Venice. But, like, the sex scene happens after Julie Christie meets with the two women and they tell her about the daughter, and she feels great about it. You know, they tell her daughter is happy and present and around them, and it's, everything is okay. And it's just, it's such a huge, exhilarating moment for her, especially him. I think he's just relieved that.
Well, yeah, that's my pushback there, which is that it means a lot to her.
Yeah.
I think it only matters to him because it means a lot to her.
Yeah.
But I think he is not just dubious, but a little worried about the effect it has on her. So I don't know that.
Not in that moment, though.
None of that. Well, there's distractions. But I don't know. I do get the sense this is the first time they've been able to be this intimate in a long time since the daughter's death. But I don't know that he's feeling the same thing that she is.
I don't see that. I mean, I see them both as being very into the minute. For what it's worth, I don't find the getting dressed thing nearly as sexy as the lead up, where they're just kind of casually naked around each other. I actually found that more charming in a way, because that's another thing you don't see much in movies, is just the way people who've been married for a long time can be very casually comfortable with each other's bodies. You know, nudity on screen is often such a big deal. It's contractual, it's complicated, there's a lot of negotiation, you have to worry about the censor board, and then on top of all of that, you know, you're trying to get actors to be comfortable with each other. And so it's just so rare to see people being naked in a way that doesn't feel like performative or calculated. It doesn't feel like it's for the audience. When they're hanging out in the bathroom together and, you know, they're just going through, you know, showering and talking to each other, and Sutherland's examining his own love handles, it really feels like an intimate moment that is for them rather than for us, which is, it's really hard to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think it sets a tone of a much more relaxed feeling than we get for any scene surrounding that one extended sequence in the hotel room, because it's so tense leading up to that scene, and then so tense afterwards. They're just in this perfect little bubble, and it's just one of those sex scenes that's not only memorable but well motivated, thoughtful, and responsive to how the characters are actually feeling at this specific moment. But so, I mean, let's kind of get into this a little bit in terms of like their relationship and who they are, because Laura seems a little bit easier to read than John. Why do you think that is?
I think they're in fairly standard gender roles. I mean, I think she's a lot more expressive, especially about her emotional response to what happened to her daughter. And I think that he is suppressed a lot of it. There's that. I mean, one of the most striking moments in the film is just when he's pulling his daughter out of the lake and he's making those horrible wounded animal noises. I mean, you just kind of see him feeling almost more naked than he does when he's getting out of the shower. Mm-hmm. It's an agonizing moment. And I think the rest of the film, you see him in recovery from that, having tamped it down and sublimated it so he's focusing on his work. But he also just has this very grim, like he says several times, our daughter is dead. Mm-hmm. He says it like it's something he has had to say to himself very grimly.
Yeah.
I get more of a sense of who she is because she says it. You know, she puts it out here. This is what I think. This is what I feel. This is what I want. Whereas, you know, he keeps basically saying, we're not talking about this. You're not allowed to experience this. We are going to react emotionally in this acceptable way.
Yeah. And I think there's a little bit of an extra burden on him because it's his fault that the kids are playing outside. That is explicitly stated. I think that gives an extra kind of weight on his shoulder.
I mean, he may feel the guilt and she may use it as leverage in a moment where she really needs leverage, but they're both parents together. I mean, neither one of them stopped their kids. I can perfectly accept that is what they both think, but it's certainly not something that I think, if that matters.
It's a fascinating phenomenon to me. It's something I really like to see explored in dramas, not just Don't Look Now, but other films as well, about how marriages end up working after the death of a child. You know, how difficult it is for them to continue on because this is the product of their relationship that is now gone. And so what does the relationship actually mean? And it's kind of exciting to see it explored here in the context of a horror film, as it is exciting, I think, we'll talk about next week with Hereditary, about how it's explored in that context too. But clearly, the marriage is not the same after something like this happens. And how do you recover, and how do you work as a couple after that?
And how do you, you know, it doesn't work out here, but they certainly seem to be in the process of learning how to reconfigure their marriage after the blow it's taken. I think the film is fatalistic about the possibility of that, but they're trying. There's an effort there as well.
One other big aspect of the film, of course, is the setting too. I mean, it's such a memorable use of Venice and its locations. I mean, what sort of picture of the city is Rogue painting here? I mean, I almost think this almost to me feels like Taxi Driver did when we did that show, and that we're seeing a city filtered through kind of the narrow perception of the protagonist of the movie, right?
Well, it's literally decadent. It's a city that's falling apart, and that's part of why he's there in the first place. But it's the setting reflects the mood of the characters. I mean, this is a place it's a place that's crumbling, and it was once solid, once the seat of an empire, and it's fallen in stature in the world over the years. It was absorbed into other empires, but beyond that, it's what's been built can't be sustained without a lot of care and new ingredients, and you know, it's the metaphor is all right there for you to parse. But beyond that, I mean, the spookiness of the place is really captured well. I've been in Venice one day, so I mean, like, I'm not like an expert on the place, but it's an otherworldly kind of place simply because of the absence of cars. I mean, there's just sounds that you expect to hear in a city that you don't hear in Venice, and it's unusual that way. And it's also, they capture how it is impossible not to get lost. It is twisty streets and like tiny alleys and little bridges going seemingly nowhere, and you can turn a corner and be back where you started. It's fascinating that way, and spooky as well.
I mean, it seems deserted in a lot of sequences, and if not deserted, then haunted by the figure that seems to be their daughter, the little shape in the red cloak. There are so many sequences where one or the other or both of them are wandering around these, you know, sort of strange hallways of like narrow bridges and canals and archways, and there's just nobody in sight, and really stark, intense lighting kind of forming the shapes of some of those arches and striking everything beyond them in shadow. And you get the sense, it almost at times feels like a set, like not a built set to shoot a movie in, but like a stage set, mm-hmm. where it's all suggestive of a larger space, but it's, you know, necessarily very stylized. And the fact that you're getting that out of real architecture is striking. I mean, just that the whole city feels stylized around the idea of emptiness and echoingness and hauntedness.
Yeah, I mean, for a city very underpopulated, deliberately underpopulated, you get one scene where they get lost and then they emerge back into a crowd, but it feels almost like some sort of a ghost, I would say like a film set. You know, and I think about other films with Venice in them. I mean, think of a film like David Lean's Summertime. Have you seen that with Katharine Hepburn?
I need to see that.
It's a good one, but I mean, it's fun. It's bright. It's summery. I mean, like Katharine Hepburn falls into the canal. I mean, it's a much different feel than Don't Look Now.
Or Telling Mr. Ripley, too. It's definitely a sunnier side of Venice. But I mean,
how much of that is in Venice, though?
Not that much. The end. On the other hand, this is very close to Death in Venice in many ways, the Visconti film, which another haunted, decadent Venice movie.
I mean, and I think it's pretty critical that the cut from Julie Christie's screaming to Venice, the first shot is of a drill going into like crumbling facade.
Rock.
Yeah, it's just like it's already a disaster. And of course, anytime he's working on this church and putting up statues or going up on that extremely rickety scaffolding, there's the sense of everything's in a collapse. There's nothing permanent or steady about the city at all.
Leaving aside the architecture, one of the big things I get out of the setting here is just a sense of displacement. Because Sutherland, he speaks a fair bit of the language, and he comes across as very collected and couth, like he feels that, you know, he's a man of the world and he knows his way around. But we keep seeing places that he just doesn't fit in with the culture at all. You know, there's the whole conflict between the bishop and the prelate in charge of the church, which seems to kind of go over his head. There's the business with the hotelier who keeps trying to get him out. Like, wait, the season is over. The summer is over. Why won't you go away? And he completely keeps missing the cues and missing what he's told. Even the sequence with the scaffolding, it kind of feels like everybody in the room knows that what he's doing is kind of like dangerous and stupid. And they're all kind of watching him like, don't you see that there is doom here, you crazy foreigner? It just, the difference between sort of how he seems to see himself and how the city responds to him, I think, is endlessly fascinating. And I do think it's kind of reflected in the ending, where he thinks he's somewhere where he belongs and where he's comfortable and where he's home, and Venice has rejected him. It's just not true.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no possibility for escape. I mean, that's the whole idea of going to Venice, was to escape and to find something new and constructive to do, and being this, you know, city that can be romantic but is anything but. So how does this fit into Nicholas Roeg's career? I mean, we should talk about him a little bit. He started as a cinematographer. I mean, we talk about David Lean. He was a second unit photographer on Lawrence of Arabia. He shot Mask of the Red Death for Roger Corman. Mm-hmm.
Good looking movie.
He shot Fahrenheit 451 for Francois Truffaut. He shot Petulia, as you mentioned. But his directorial, from the beginning, performance with 1970, you know, his voice as a filmmaker is quite distinctive. Well, how would you describe it?
Well, that's another movie about, you know, identities that kind of merge and blur in some interesting ways, which is somewhat true of this as well. But that's a very sort of tough film to describe. I mean, have you seen it, Scott?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I mean, it's so experimental. The cutting, it's so aggressive. It's far beyond even what he does in Don't Look Now.
Yeah, for sure. And Walkabout is really a favorite film of mine. And another film, just a little bit of plot, it's set in Australia, the Australian outback, where a couple of white kids get separated it. They're separated from society.
They go on a walkabout.
Yeah, they go on a walkabout with a young Aboriginal man, and it's a lot of just them wandering around nature. But there's more to it than that. It has really one of the most devastatingly heartbreaking edits I've ever seen in a movie, which I will definitely not spoil.
Yeah.
And Man Who Fell to Earth, which I feel that maybe he was emboldened by Don't Look Now to even take things a little further. That's another film about loss and time and communication and people losing their identity. There's a
and
lot.
Casual nudity.
Yeah, there's a lot of
The most perfect David Bowie role ever conceived.
Yeah, you can't cast anyone.
He's an alien.
But David Bowie in that role. But Bad Timing, I remember liking, and it's kind of makes use of Vienna the way this makes use of Venice, but the details of it are
an intensified sensuality too in that film too.
Any film with Art Garfunkel is going to have very intense sensuality.
And Keitel, that's Keitel solidly in his erotic prime.
The piano.
He's been there for us for decades.
I see so much kind of like basically in his work a combination of like gauzy dreaminess and those really abrupt, like, sharp cuts. Like, he's a really big fan of sudden, harsh zooms forcing you to look at something. Mm-hmm. And of those really sharp, abrupt cuts, again, kind of forcing you to look at something. And he has a tendency to edit these, like, long, almost sleepy scenes and then, you know, jump on you with something. And, I mean, I see that in A Man Who Fell to Earth. I see it in Walkabout. I saw The Witches so separately from his other films.
Yeah.
And it's just such a different species of animal in so many ways.
Yeah.
I kind of want to go back and revisit that one and look like specifically for his kind of editing and shooting tricks. But
they're not there. I mean, so the shooting tricks are there. I mean, it's beautifully photographed. I really love The Witches from 1990.
As a cinematographer, he does tend to like his really intense color, and that's a big thing in The Witches.
Yeah, and it means something. And it means something in Don't Look Now, too. I mean, the color red obviously figures pretty prominently in the movie, and it allows us to make intuitive connections rather than connections that are made through more conventional storytelling means, which is, you know, a very risky thing to do, but is kind of what sets him apart.
You say that, I keep having to remind myself that he did not direct Picnic at Hanging Rock, because I conflate that movie with his career so much, because it's about the same like strange supernatural unexplained occurrences. It's about the same visually gauzy sexuality. It's about the same sort of sense of dreaming in the real world. It's just, to me, it feels so much like a Nicholas Rogue movie in so many ways.
The Walkabout, like, you know, Australia was of interest to him as well.
Certainly.
Yeah, I can see him making that. You know, it's a little off topic, but speaking of connections, and we'll obviously talk a lot about this with Hereditary, but you can see so many films borrowed from this. Like the scene where the two women are alone and there's kind of cackling and we don't know why they're cackling. It's so much the scene from Mulholland Drive with the older couple when we see them cackling on their own.
I thought you were going to say Suspiria.
Well, Suspiria. Yeah, no, I mean, well, Giallo in general and Argento in particular owe a lot to this film as well.
We just saw The First Purge like two nights ago and I'm thinking, you know, the two ladies with their shopping carts and their stuffed animals.
With the Rick James sound. Track, yeah.
I mean, their relationship feels very, very similar to that.
Yeah, it kind of does.
And they definitely have that scene where they're cackling together and they've kind of like shut out the world because they're alone in their strange little space.
It's an easy film to borrow from, I guess.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I think the director of Hereditary may have taken a look at this film as well, but we'll talk about that in the next episode. In the meantime, we'll be right back to get in some feedback on recent episodes. Now it's time for feedback, when our listeners weigh in with their responses to recent episodes and anything else in the world of film. Our pairing of Goldfinger and Incredibles 2 got some thoughtful feedback from our superheroic podcast subscribers. Keith, do you want to get us started?
Sure. Lucas from New York has some thoughts on the memorable music in James Bond and the Incredibles movies. He writes, I was intrigued by this week's pairing of Incredibles 2 and Goldfinger, and I thought you brought up some very interesting stylistic points, but at no point did you really talk about the music. You spoke briefly about the Bond theme and John Barry's fantastic score, but you didn't mention Michael Giacchino's miraculous, vibrant, ecstatic work on The Incredibles, which along with his jaw-dropping and sumptuous work on Ratatouille are two of the best scores, not just of their decade, but of all time. Giacchino has proven to be one of the great composers working today, but one aspect of his career that is undervalued is that, like J.J. Abrams, he is unparalleled in his ability to make his music feel like other people's work. His Rogue One score, famously written and recorded in 4 weeks, sounds like a spot-on continuation of John Williams' iconic work. His score on Mission Impossible 3 and 4 is a bombastic extension of Lalo Schifrin's work. His outstanding track, Roar, that plays only during the credits of Cloverfield, is the best part of the movie and feels like a cousin of Godzilla. And recently, he's wasted his time trying to breathe life into those Jurassic Park sequels. It is worth pointing out that while The Incredibles was Michael Giacchino's first feature film score, he was not the first choice. The original composer was David Arnold, a composer notable for his work on such films as Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough, Die Another Day, and Casino Royale. In fact, the teaser trailer for The Incredibles, the one with Mr. Incredible suiting up for an adventure, only to be thwarted by his tiny belt and protruding gut, features a track from On Her Majesty's Secret Service as the tone setter. It is also almost note for note the theme to The Incredibles. More than the style, the flash, the gadgets, or in this case, powers, I think the incredible strongest link to the world of Bond is in its soundtrack, which plays almost like a jazzy cover to Bond classics. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go rewatch The Incredibles. This is a good letter, and I agree. If Giacchino, he's great. Yeah,
I love letters that where I learn something. This is all on me as a moderator. I made a point of bringing up the soundtrack and score with Bond, and I really meant to bookend it in Connections. And we had a bunch of other things to talk about, and it slipped my mind. But Incredibles 2 in some ways left me cold, and the two things that just kind of kept me energized throughout were the action sequences and the soundtrack. Like, that soundtrack is so thrilling and exciting, and it really moves the emotional along in ways that maybe the first film didn't need as much, but it becomes a really necessary crutch, I think, in two. I mean, it very much evokes the Mission Impossible theme. It very much has that kind of jazzy 60s feel, and to some degree, I feel like the entire period aspect of these films comes more from the need for like that style of soundtrack than it comes from anything in the narrative that says it's got to be set in that 50s, 60s era.
Yeah, I love that it's his first score, his first feature film score anyway. It's like, oh, first try, what are you going to do? Oh, yeah, it's great.
I'm going to knock it out of the park. Isn't that what you do?
Yeah, he'd done apparently shorts and a lot of video games before that, including Medal of Honor, when it was like the World War II series of games. So it has like that kind of John Williams, Saving Private Ryan feel to the, if I remember his music for that correctly. But yeah, he's remarkable. It's definitely a name that I look forward to seeing.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm going to take exception with the idea that Roar is the best part of Cloverfield, because I love Cloverfield. But Roar may be the first time I've ever laughed out loud at a completely like nonverbal musical thing. Like it isn't recognition of like a reference or a song I know. It was just when it started playing over the credits, when it started building and I could see musically where it was going, I laughed out loud in the theater out of literally sheer delight, because it was just so much an evocation of Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And it was so much an acknowledgement. It felt like the resolution that the movie itself didn't have. It felt like the emotional catharsis that the movie didn't give us. It is, I think, both a tremendous piece of music and just a really appropriate piece of music for the end of that film.
What are some of your favorite scores? For me, I think it's Planet of the Apes scores were both really great. But Inside Out, to me,
that's
is
the
like,
one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just because I have powerful associations with that film, but that just the music for that will make me a little misty, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to make the same point. I don't even know if that's entirely to his credit or to the credit of the film itself, but there is that associative thing where as soon as I hear that score, it's like, oh boy, here come the waterworks.
Here we go. Yeah.
So this week we also got some interesting Incredibles 2 criticism on our Facebook page from listener Ben. Tasha?
Ben writes, for me, the crux of the original Incredibles was the mundane domestic issues of adolescence and middle age, which are heightened to exciting extremes by the superhero motif. Unfortunately, Incredibles 2 just seems to double down on the superheroism while leaving the personal stories to stagnate. We again look at the conflict between a domestic and a professional parent, albeit with the genders reversed this time, while the children essentially grapple with the exact same challenges they faced in the first film. One bristles under the restrictions imposed on him as a kid, the other restricts herself out of shyness. Sure, I enjoyed watching Elastigirl land a runaway helicopter, but splashy action sequences are par for the course with the superhero genre. What set The Incredibles apart was how it used the genre as a vehicle for telling a story about family. Hopefully, once Incredibles 3 rolls around, they'll remember what made this series appealing in the first place. Perhaps they can let the characters age a little and explore the other challenges families face later in life. How do Dash and Violet react when they leave home and finally get the freedom they want? How do Bob and Helen react as they approach retirement and finally have to admit their best years are behind them? And what will Jack-Jack look like when it comes time for him to actually live up to his potential? These are the sorts of questions I'd love to see the Parr family answer in the future, rather than seeing them simply face new supervillains while remaining the same themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a limitation, a self-imposed limitation, of starting the new film right where the last one left off. So you can't catch them at a different time in their lives. They're right. You know, they've grown a little bit in the over the course of The Incredibles, but they can't. It would be a much different thing if we started, you know, 5 years in the future, 10 years in the future, and they're much different characters with much different lives and conflicts. And maybe that will be something we'll see in Incredibles 3 14 years from now when it gets made. So I think what we ended up seeing with Incredibles 2 is a little bit safe franchise maintenance, which is not the most exciting thing you want from a movie, especially a sequel to a film that was so thrilling. You know, you don't want it just to see the further adventures of, doesn't quite cut it, I guess, as well. And I think that's kind of what we, the consensus we sort of came to on the show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree 100% with this letter. For me, the problem is, yes, you're catching them at the exact same time in their lives, but you're also catching them as they've all, in the moment that they've all just kind of come off of coming to a place of satisfaction. If the story was about how just having one confident moment with a boy doesn't necessarily mean you know how to handle more of a relationship, that finally getting to race or finally getting to take superheroic action is not going to satisfy you for life. Like, if the movie had taken any time whatsoever to examine the fact that, like, the arcs that they all went through in the first film weren't necessarily enough to change a life, that would have been really interesting and daring and, like, Pixarian thing to do. Like, to examine, there's always the question of what happens after the happily ever after. Incredibles 2 had a really good happily ever after for everybody except the villain. And then we dial back on all of those things. And as he says here, it feels like they're fighting the exact same battles and not in an interesting or fulfilling way.
I'll just add kind of what, you know, the concise opinion I had last week, which is, yeah, but I like it.
Yeah, that is true, too. I mean, I think of the Pixar playing it safe sequels, it's the best sequel outside of the Toy Story movies in that respect.
I would love to see something that what Ben suggests, which is essentially would be an Incredibles equivalent to Toy Story 2 or 3, where we're actually pushing these characters forward in time and dealing with different periods of their life.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be much harder to do that with an Incredibles 3, having done this with an Incredibles 2.
Yeah.
You know, even if it had pushed forward a year or two, there might have been an opportunity to do something radical like Toy Story 3 did. But here it's going to feel a little weird if we get these two movies that are like within minutes of each other, and then suddenly we try to move forward to, hey, Jack's 18. Like, here's what he's doing at superhero college.
How about a sequel where past and present kind of merge and flow seamlessly, edited in really evocative ways, directed by Nicholas Rogue.
With a detailed, lengthy sex scene between Bob
Anthony
and Helen.
Lane would like that.
Yeah, way too many people on the internet would. No, as a matter of fact, I know what I really want Incredibles 3 to be, and I'm hoping by the time this podcast hits, I have written that piece and put it on the internet.
Well, we'll look forward to that. That wraps up our feedback for this episode. We always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll bring in Hereditary and consider how its own family tragedy reverberates through the survivors' lives in bone-chilling ways. Starting with this pair of episodes, the Next Picture Show will roll out on a weekly basis rather than twice every 2 weeks. So every Tuesday, you'll get a new episode of the show. So look for our Hereditary episode next Tuesday, or better yet, subscribe to the Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be hanging out in some indeterminate temporal space and feeling really uncomfortable.